Welcome, and it's a great privilege to be able to have Scott here talking to us, and obviously many of you have come to hear what he's got to say. It's interesting. I mean, there's so many wars and conflicts at the moment. I've never been in a war situation. I've never even thought what it might be like for the people in the current in Lebanon at the moment, and situations there, both for the civilians and also for the armed forces. Scott has lived through that, and it's great that he's able to share some of his experiences with us. Just a couple of lines by way of background from a press article. Major Scott Watkins was on secondment to the British Army when he piloted a helicopter to safety after it had been damaged by enemy fire, which also injured his co-pilot near Baghdad in November 2004. His bravery in that incident, and again a few days later, when another helicopter he was piloting was also hit by enemy fire, have earned Major Watkins the first Distinguished Flying Cross in Australia in 33 years. So please welcome Scott.
Gents, it's my great honour and privilege to be able to stand before you this morning to share in the way the Lord has blessed not only me but also those with whom I served in Iraq, and I certainly look forward this morning to just giving you a few details and just letting you know how that actually occurred. Before I start, though, I'd like to personally thank Graham and Doug, who's obviously not here, for their efforts in organising this morning and making it so easy for me to get down here and present this morning. I was born and bred in Queensland, very proud Queenslander, so it hurts me a little bit to be in Victoria because you guys don't play enough rugby on TV, but that's okay. I was predominantly educated in Queensland, in Brisbane, but my folks moved to Sydney in my late teens, and I finished my high schooling and started a bit of university in Sydney before I then moved into the private sector and worked for a company before I then joined the Army. I started off, I spent 18 months at the Royal Military College Duntroon back in 92-93. And I actually graduated to the Corps of Infantry through a fairly long story, but I joined to become a pilot, but I ended up becoming an infantryman, so figure that one out. However, I spent three years as an infantry officer before I then went across to become a pilot. And I started my pilot training, I think, in 97 and finished it towards the middle of 98. I was posted to Darwin, to our reconnaissance squadron up there, which is the guys who fly the Bell 206s, for those of you who know aircraft. And I saw service in Bougainville and two tours of East Timor whilst I was with that particular unit. Following that, in 2002, I was the aide-de-camp to General Peter Cosgrove as the Chief of Army, the then Chief of Army. That was the year he was actually promoted to the Chief of Defence Force, so I served 6 months with him, and then the new Chief of Army, which is General Peter Lay, who is the current Chief of Army, took over, and I stayed on for the rest of that year, so 6 months with him as his ADC. Following that year, 2003-2004, I was on exchange with the British, and I'll go into a bit more detail about that shortly. And then once I'd finished that, I found myself here in Victoria, posted to Puckapunyal, which is about an hour's drive north of here, for those of you who don't know, around very close to Seymour. I'm there as a advanced tactics instructor, so I teach the mid-level officers, so captain, major level officers, about combined arms tactics, and basically just the integration of aviation, armour, infantry, engineers and artillery, and I'm the aviation expert, if you like, within that group. In terms of my Christian life, I was, and I can't give thanks for this enough, I was brought up in a Christian family, so I can't think of any greater blessing that a parent can give to a child than to bring them up in a Christian family. And I found myself committing my life to the Lord in 1984 when I was only 13 years of age. When we moved to Sydney, I met my future wife at the church we were attending in Borkham Hills, and we married in 95, shortly after I'd sort of, in my second year as a platoon commander down in one of the battalions in Sydney. We were baptised in 99 when we were up in Darwin attending Darwin Baptist Church. And we now have two children, Brianna, who's 4 years old, and Lachlan, who's about 15, 16 months. And they are great kids. So those of you who have kids, I'm sure we would agree they're a great thing to have. I'll talk to you now about the exchange. I mentioned that I was went on exchange with the British during 2003-2004, and I'll just cover a few points in relation to that in terms of an overview. I'll then talk to you about the operational experience that I had in Iraq with the British, and just put a bit of a perspective on that at the end. In terms of the exchange, the Australian Army has a number of exchanges, and within the Australian Army Aviation Corps, of which I'm part, we have an exchange with the British, and we have two exchanges with the Americans. One's with the 101st Airborne, the other one's with the 82nd Airborne. One Black Hawk and one's a Kiowa exchange. My exchange, as I said earlier, 2003 to 2005, January of, and I was with a unit called 652 Squadron, which is one of the oldest squadrons in the British Army Air Corps, which is part of one regiment, which is a helicopter battalion, Army Air Corps. And that's based in an area in Germany. It's the only regiment that's based in Germany, in a town called Gütersloh, which is about halfway between Dusseldorf and Hanover. Flew predominantly the Lynx Mark 7, which is the aircraft you can see in the picture there, and which is the skidded version of the Lynx. And then I transitioned onto the Mark 9 in the last 6 months of my exchange, which is the wheeled version, and you saw a few pictures of that earlier, and that's what I flew in Iraq. Very little difference between the two aircraft. The Mark 9s are slightly newer than the Mark 7s, and that's about it. I was very, very fortunate to go on some amazing exercises with the British. After my conversion onto Lynx in the UK and our move to Germany, I was on a two-week exercise in Norway in the middle of summer and flying around fjords and whatnot in Norway. I'll never forget that. A lot of exercises, as you can imagine, in Germany, flying around places like Berchtesgaden and around Bavaria and the Nischwanstein or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Castle. Did a few orbits around that as well. And obviously a bit of flying in the UK. And then in 2004, went on an exercise in Kenya. The British don't have a lot of room in the UK to do exercises, so they find themselves in places like Canada and Kenya to do exercises. And I went and supported one of those. And Kenya was a very good lead-in to what we were about to do in Iraq because of the performance degradation that we found in the aircraft, given that we were operating quite high altitudes and there was a lot of dust there. We'd been told just prior to going to Kenya, so at the beginning of 2004, that our regiment was to rotate into Iraq. And so in September 2004, my squadron rotated in, and I stayed there until 14th of January 2005, as you can see on the screen there. Operation Telic is what the Brits call their commitment to Iraq. Australia has its own name for the commitment to Iraq. The British name is Operation Telic, and that's pretty normal it's a NATO thing to do, I suppose. They control an area in the south of Iraq which is called a divisional area of operations, and that area is called the Multinational Division Southeast. Whilst I was there, there were a number of countries involved in that particular area, and they included those listed there. including the Kiwis. The Kiwis were there up until October 2004. You didn't really hear too much about the Kiwis. They kept pretty quiet. But they were in theatre. That's just a bit of a map of the area. The multinational division this area here. For those of you who are familiar with the current Australian operations, they're based in Samoa, which is in this area here, and they're about to move to a place called Talil, which is about where my shaky dot is on the M&D Southeast sign. Interestingly, for those who know a little bit of Bible history, Talil used to be called Ur, which is the birthplace of Abraham, and I'll flash up something on that shortly. And it's an amazing country because this whole area used to be known as southern Mesopotamia. You've got Ur here, you've got the Euphrates River that runs through here, Babel you can just see there, the ruins of Babylon are in that location there. The Tigris runs through just to the north and meets down in the south here. And Babylon's where, obviously, Nebuchadnezzar was. And Daniel stood on the river, on the edge of the Tigris River, and saw some of his prophecies to Nebuchadnezzar in that area. You still, to this day, see buildings made out of mud brick. And I don't know if you noticed in that video that a lot of the buildings are just like earth buildings. They are still the same buildings, I think, that they built back in Jesus's time. They're still that flat roof, mud brick buildings. There's a few of them have got satellite dishes bolted onto the side and whatnot these days, but they are still essentially the same buildings. And there's still shepherds wandering around in the bush with their staff and their little flock of sheep. And for me, it was a very interesting to fly over these guys, because obviously I had to fly very low whilst I was there, so I usually scared, unfortunately, a lot of these blokes and their sheep. But it was very interesting to watch the sheep scatter and then look for their shepherd and then come back to the shepherd, because they knew that was safe around him. So the analogies that Jesus uses about the shepherd and his sheep certainly struck a chord with me whilst I was there. That's a bit of a blow up there of the multinational division southeast area. That's Samoa there, where the Australians are looking after the Japanese, and they're moving to here, which is Talil, I mentioned. Basra is where I was mainly based, and as you can see, that forms part. Well, the British basically have a brigade there that looks after this particular area, the Al Basra area, and Maysan province. Now, whilst I was there, that was a fairly sporting province. In the 2 or 3 months before I got there, a bloke won a Victoria Cross in Alamara for his actions in relation to some fairly heavy fighting that was going on in that area. The Italians, who I think are just starting to pull out, looked after the central province here, and the Dutch at the time looked after this area here. The Australians are now look after about that area there, with the British looking after the remainder. And that has now recently transitioned to the Iraqis. They now look after that area, which is a very important step in handing back the country, if you like, to the Iraqi people. Of other interest there is Al-Kurna here. That's where the Euphrates River, which comes in from here, and the Tigris River meet. Definitely not accurate, but in that location, they actually do have a little monument there to say this is where the Garden of Eden was and the Tree of Life, but I'm pretty sure it's geographically incorrect, because only a couple of hundred years ago, the Euphrates and the Tigris used to actually flow. Oops, I'll go back one. The Euphrates and the Tigris used to actually just flow straight into the Gulf there, so... there's been a bit of a silt build-up and whatnot. So not 100% correct, but still quite interesting. That's the ziggurat at Ur, possibly the oldest, if not one of the oldest, buildings on Earth. And that's what they think the Tower of Babel sort of was built like back in the days when it was built. And that's obviously, as I was saying earlier, where Abraham, that was the temple in the town where Abraham was born. Right, cutting across to Basra. I worked for an organisation within that multinational division southeast called the Joint Helicopter Force. And essentially, that was a helicopter battalion, and it comprised of all three services within the British Defence Force, if you like. And each service provided a different capability. The Army provided the Lynx helicopter, which was light utility, bit of reconnaissance, photo reconnaissance and escort, and I'll talk about the duties that we sort of did in a moment. And the Air Force looked after troop lift and more heavier or medium troop lift with the Chinook and the Puma. And then shortly, because the Sea King provides a similar capability to the Puma, the Royal Navy came in at about halfway through my tour there to replace the Pumas, just as, because that's what they do, just to keep a rotation going through so people aren't spending forever in country. In terms of the things that I did, most of my flying involved that, carrying people around, carrying stores around, nothing too glamorous. I did a lot of flying within that sort of AO that I showed you earlier, the area of operations, and also a bit of work in Kuwait. The more exciting stuff was the convoy escorts. I used to sit over the top of vehicle convoys as they travelled north. That area that I showed you earlier, Alamara, where the guy won the Victoria Cross, the route between there and Basra was what the British called their own sort of IED or improvised explosive device alley, where guys would basically plant bombs on the side of the road to try and blow up the convoys. If you could put a helicopter over the top of that convoy whilst it was moving north, then generally the IEDs weren't detonated because of the nature of the way they needed to detonate and how quickly an aircraft could cover ground either side of the road. It meant it was very difficult to hide after detonating an IED and they'd be discovered. So that was one of the reasons why we were so effective in doing that. And it was a very rewarding thing to do. Overwatch. Often there are operations planned within the cities, whether that was Basra or Alamara, and we would sit over the top of the guys in the cities, give them a bit of information as to what was going on, or we would sit as or would be react to an incident response, and get over the top of the guys and let them know what was happening. So if there was a shooting match going on underneath you, you could tell them where the people were that were shooting at them or where they had moved to because you had that sort of eagle eyes view of what was going on. Now, we did a little bit of photo reconnaissance and a little bit of miscellaneous tasking. I put that up there because it's quite interesting. The bank run down to, I had to do a few of those. I went down to a base in Kuwait. I picked up $15 million US in cash. And that is very, very heavy, and it was very interesting. We figured out between the three of us we could have taken off somewhere else and we would never have earned that much money in a lifetime. But we also did a few strange things, like look for the UAVs, are the unmanned aerial vehicles that look, that we looked for the British version of Predator, if you like. Quite, sometimes it would crash and we'd try and go out and find where it was, but never, ever found them. They're pretty small model planes, basically. Okay, after about 2 months in theatre, I went on another operation within Iraq called Operation Bracken. And whilst I've just got that photo up, and I'll explain what Bracken is on the next slide, obviously that's me there. This is Keith Reesby, my co-pilot, when we went up to support Bracken. And this is my door gunner here, a guy called Dinger Ling, Corporal Ling. But and I still don't know his first name. Okay, Operation Bracken. It was towards the end of the one of the battalion's rotations, which was the 1st Black Watch, 1st Battalion, the Black Watch rotation in Iraq. The Marines wanted to go back, the US Marines wanted to go back into Fallujah to clear out what was an insurgent stronghold. And in order to do that, they needed to pull forces from various areas to cordon off the city and then to go in and actually assault. And in order for them to do that, they needed to actually have extra troops to fill the gaps that they were creating by pulling these troops in to attack Fallujah. So they went to the British and they said, can you give us a battalion to support us in the second assault into Fallujah? So Tony Blair extended the Black Watch in theatre for an extra couple of months and sent them up to Fallujah, or close to Fallujah, to support this particular operation. Now, this was very controversial back in the UK because the media got hold of it. Tony Blair had said people were prepared for this battalion to come home, so he'd extended them. So there was a bit of annoyance that the Black Watch had been extended in theatre. They were moving from a relatively benign area in the southeast to a hostile area, or the area known as the Sunni Triangle, and that was a controversial thing in itself because they felt that their soldiers were being put under more threat. And thirdly, because Tony Blair had made such a big deal of it, there was so much media attention that it was actually it played against the British. Now, I can tell you the soldiers were very much looking forward to going up and doing this because that's what soldiers do. They actually like to fight if they can. And they thought this was a good thing, but back home it was poorly played in the press. And the insurgents, who aren't stupid, got hold of it and basically put a bit, we believe, a bit of a concerted effort against the British and when they moved up. They were tasked, the battalion was tasked with assisting in blocking insurgents to the south east, coming out of Fallujah and filling the gap of one of the United States Marine Corps units. And they were based at a place called Camp Dogwood, and I'll flash up a map showing that in a moment. Because of that media attention, within the first 4 days of the battalion getting up there, they suffered 6 killed in action and 2 wounded in action. That was as all of those, bar one killed in action, were as a result of suicide vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices. So blokes driving cars up to checkpoints and with the car filled with explosive and detonating themselves and killing the British guys around them. Very, very average. The 2 guys who were wounded were standing behind the back door of a Warrior, which is a big sort of armoured personnel carrier, and they both lost their legs from the knee down, but had their bodies or their torsos protected by the fact they were standing behind the door when the IED went off. But that IED also took out 2 guys and an interpreter as well. So it's a very morale-sapping thing to see because there's not too much you can do about it. If somebody wants to kill themselves and take you with them, then there's not too much you can do about that. As a result of the first 2 days of casualties, the battalion commander was asked by our general who ran the multinational division southeast what he wanted, and one of the first things he asked for was for some integral aviation support. Now, the Americans were supporting the Black Watch in terms of casualty evacuation, and to tell you the truth, no one could do it slicker than the way that the Americans do. They can honestly do things with that medical evacuation I still to this day can't figure out how they do it so well. They're an amazing organisation in that regard. But they wanted aviation to, in that sort of support role that I sort of mentioned earlier, sitting over the top, feeding them information and all that kind of good stuff. So as a result, I went up in the Air Corps Lynx, and an RAF Puma came up with us to operate in mutual support. So we basically looked after each other, and I commanded that sort of aviation detachment up in Dogwood on Operation Bracken. That's a map just to orientate you. I didn't point out Baghdad before on that map, but it was the larger scale map. But I think most of you have got a fairly good idea where Baghdad is. Baghdad International Airport just sits to the southwest there, and Fallujah sits over here. That distance there is about 30 k's, and Camp Dogwood, which sits on the southern side of the Euphrates River, which wanders through there, is about 25-30 k's as well from Baghdad. Again, very interesting area. The Tigris River runs through here, and the gap, this area between the Tigris and the Euphrates, is fertile, lush farming land. You literally come 100 metres off the Euphrates River here, and you're straight into classic sandy desert. It's an amazing place that you could have such diverse ecosystems in two areas so close is an amazing thing. So we found ourselves sitting in the sand down here. Okay, a few key events. I got up to with the Puma up to Dogwood on the afternoon of the 8th of November. We did some tasking for them on the 9th, and then on the 10th of November we had our first significant contact, which was the one in which Keith was wounded. On the 11th of November, whilst patrolling, we identified an observation post. That's what IOP stands for, an observation post that the insurgents were using to adjust rocket fire into our position, and we'd come under rocket attack pretty well every single day that we were there up until this position was identified. On the 12th of November, had a second contact, which Sir Graham mentioned in his introduction, and I'll speak about that in a moment. And then on the 13th, we conducted what's called Eagle Vehicle Checkpoints, and essentially all that is putting soldiers in the back of an aircraft and flying to a part of a road, like finding a road that we think people were operating on, putting the aircraft on the ground, soldiers jump out, set up a vehicle checkpoint, check a few vehicles, aircraft takes off, sits over the top, and we watch them as they do that, come back down, pick them up, and then we move to another road or another place on the road, and then we do the whole thing again. The beauty of that is that it's so unpredictable, it's very hard to target the guys when they're doing something like that. So the incidence of... It's highly unlikely that somebody with is driving around looking to blow up Brits or blow up Allied troops, that they'll be able to actually pinpoint them on the ground and detonate themselves. It was a very flexible means, but also an efficient means of checking vehicles without getting blown up. Righty-o. The contact on the 10th of November. I mentioned we arrived on the 8th, and on the 9th we'd done a little bit of picking up stores and equipment out of Baghdad International Airport. On the 10th we arrived at Dogwood, and we were asked to pick up another group of stores and equipment that had been flown up from Basra into Baghdad. And we're looking at the tasking sheet, it looked like we were going to need about three runs into Baghdad Airport to get everything out. So about 10 o'clock on the 10th, we launched out and flew this sort of easterly route into the airport, and picked up the stores and then returned. And then on return, I took fuel. And whilst we were taking fuel, the navigator of the Puma came up and said, look, how about we go in via a different route into the airport? Because over the last couple of days, we'd actually flown a variation of this route about three times. And you want to avoid setting patterns so people can't ambush you. So I thought that was a particularly good idea. So I tasked the Puma, once we'd got our fuel, to lead us out and fly via a more westerly route, basically between Fallujah and Baghdad, to get us into the airport. So at 11 o'clock, Puma in the lead, and us in what we call combat crews, which is effectively lead aircraft, lead navigates, rear aircraft has this freedom of arc at the rear to basically just patrol and just keep an eye on each other. It's no sort of set formation, but that's sort of how we were sitting when we departed. About 7 minutes north, 7 minutes out of Baghdad, heading north, after crossing the Euphrates River, the first I sort of knew that something was happening when it was when I heard a massive explosion in the cockpit, and that's basically the only way I can describe it. What appeared to be a mist form in front of Keith, and this distinct smell of cordite in the cockpit. Now, obviously, I also heard a yell of pain as well. Now, I'll talk about four miracles that I think the Lord was sort of blessed us with at this time. And the first one is that when this round hit the aircraft, I was actually, contrary to some of the media reports that came through later, I was actually on the controls when we were hit. Now, that might sound a little bit obvious or even trivial in some ways, but up until that point, I actually hadn't been doing very much flying because we were new to the area. I was the aircraft commander, so I was trying to get a feel for what was going on, manage the radios, get to know the area and whatnot. And the best way to do that is to load shed and give you the pilot, the other pilot, all the flying, tell him where to go, and you sort of figure out what was going on. So up until that point, Keith had actually been doing the vast majority of flying, and it was only in this stretch, in this stretch here that I started to fly. So when Keith was hit and this mist, which actually turned out to be debris from the Perspex window that I saw, he was actually hit in the right arm, which would have been the arm that he would have been flying the aircraft with. Now, bear in mind, we were flying at about 15 metres above the ground, travelling at about just over 200 k's an hour. So we were absolutely motoring. And you can't, any mistake at that speed and at that height can be catastrophic. So to manoeuvre the aircraft, to have the controls blown out of his hand, basically, could have meant that we found ourselves in the dirt before I could have had time to recover. So I consider that to be a miracle in that, you know, I wasn't on the controls up until that point. After the initial shock, which I could tell you took about a millisecond to compute, I suppose instinctively rolled the aircraft away from where I thought we were being shot at. Now, I thought the round had actually come through the floor and not from our right-hand side. So I banked the aircraft around to the left, as you can sort of see in the diagram, and then manoeuvred the aircraft to what we call break contact from the guys that were shooting at us. And then as we were manoeuvring, Keith let me know that he'd actually been shot in the arm. I spoke about Dinger, the door gunner. Because I was the aircraft commander and we only have one gun in the links, the door gunner sits on the same side as the commander, so Dinger had no opportunity to actually engage the guys who were shooting us out on the right because I was sitting on the left. And so when we manoeuvred, I brought Dinger around onto our side of the guys who were shooting us out onto our side of the aircraft, mainly just through manoeuvring. I wasn't actually deliberately trying to get him to try and shoot back. But he actually saw the guys as part of that manoeuvring, saw three guys on the ground with AK-47s shooting in out of a ditch, if you like, just near us as we manoeuvred away. I banked away again and kept going to the south and decided not to try and re-engage the enemy because of Keith's injuries. And we continued to the south and Dinger started to pass what we call first field dressings forward to Keith to dress his wounds. Now, Keith's wounds at the time, he didn't think were overly serious. He said to me that he looked down at his arm and he said in his mind his arm was sitting like this, but when he looked down he said his arm was sitting like that. And at first he said he thought he'd lost his arm because it was in a position that he hadn't actually, wasn't computing within his mind, but quickly realised that he hadn't. Now this is where it's definitely a second miracle, because when I tell you what happened with this round that went into Keith's body. It's amazing that he didn't suffer more serious injuries. Now, Keith dressed the wound himself, and he dressed his arm, and what he found was a round had gone through his arm and had exited his armpit. And now we wear a Kevlar chicken plate, we call it. So basically a breastplate. And the round had got in behind that, skirted along the edge of the chicken plate, ricocheted off the edge of it, back into his chest, hit his dog tags on his sternum, if you like, ricocheted off them, and then gone into his left pec, and then stopped an inch from his heart. Now, we're talking about an inch-long piece of 7.62 millimetre diameter piece of metal. This round didn't hit any bones, didn't hit any major organs, and didn't hit any arteries. It was all muscle. Keith, to his credit at the time, dressed as best he could that wound, but and realised that he had blood pooling in his lap and had a chest wound as well shortly afterwards. But to receive a shot from a round at the range that we were at, and not have more serious injuries, I consider to be a miracle at the very least. And Keith even said that to me. He said, "Look, I'm glad I was flying with you," he said, because he said, "I think your faith saved me." And I sort of went, "Oh, well, not really, mate." But an amazing sort of wound to walk away with. And he was actually back in theatre 6 months later, flying again, which is something a great credit to him as well. Something else that was after we were shot, the Puma actually kept flying to the north. They didn't actually know we'd been shot, and they continued to the north. So whilst we were flying back, I was frantically on the radio trying to get hold of them to let them know what was going on, and also letting the guys down in Dogwood know that we were shot, had been shot, and that we were coming in with a wounded guy. So there was a fair bit of activity coming back in, and we landed back in Dogwood again about 6 or 7 minutes later. Put the aircraft on the ground, and Keith, again to his credit, pretty well pulled himself halfway out of the aircraft before we could get round to him and help him out. So pretty strong bloke, pretty up top, very solid, he showed a lot of guts and determination, I suppose, and to sort of help us out in that particular incident. Puma eventually got hold of, and he came in and landed behind us. Shortly after landing, I had to obviously go and give a report to the guys in the headquarters and let them know what had happened. And that was actually the last time I saw Keith until I saw him again in Germany when I returned in January of the following year. And this is where that sort of slick American medevac system came into play. Keith was on a Black Hawk helicopter within 15 minutes of us landing at Dogwood. He's on an operating table within an hour up at Kaish, which is the hospital up in Baghdad. So for those of you who know about the golden hour, he was on an operating table receiving the treatment that he needed at the surgery before that hour had expired. So the Americans were particularly slick, and to this day, as I sort of said earlier, I'm not sure how they did it. Came back out to the aircraft afterwards, spoke to my engineer, and he went and had a look at the aircraft, and this is what he found. The aircraft had actually been hit by not one but three rounds, this is where miracle number three sort of comes in, because that first round there came straight through underneath Keith's seat, cut all the way across the aircraft and actually hit my collective, which is the device that I use to control power, climb, descend, hover with the aircraft, and it actually sheared the control in half. But there was enough metal on it for me not to have realised that the control had been seriously damaged, and it ricocheted out through the bottom. Second round went through and was the one that struck Keith. And the third round passed a foot behind the two engines and basically hit those things we call, the British call wheelie bins, weema bins, and they call them weema bins. But they're the IR infrared suppression ducts on the back of the engines to reduce the infrared signature, so surface-to-air missiles can't have difficulty tracking the aircraft. And again, I'm thankful for that hitting where it did hit. If it had hit the engine, I would have been dealing with multiple emergencies with an injured crew and at low level, and it would have been a nightmare, to say the very least. That's where the first round hit, and that's where it exited after shearing my collective link out the belly of the aircraft. That's the second round. And just take note of how nice and round that hole is. That indicates that the guys were very, very close to us. They were shooting... we're pretty sure they were shooting at the Puma, because remember, we're sort of sitting like this, shooting at the Puma, and then we came across them and they basically just sprayed straight onto us, so they got the lead that they needed. So you need to shoot in front of an aircraft, basically, if you want to hit it. Not that I told you that. But they got the lead they needed to hit the aircraft and to hit us, and that's how they got us at that speed and that height, because it's unusual to be hit travelling that fast, that low, with small arms fire. And that's the third round through the IRCM duct and where it exited. That one round put four holes in the aircraft, because the two WEMA bins have obviously their own two walls on the side, so it put four holes. And you can see the mess that it makes after it starts tumbling and comes out the other side. Shortly after I'd finished taking those photos, because we had a military police guy come down as well and he wanted to take photos for his own investigation. Whilst we were doing that, I was walking around the aircraft and I heard what I can only describe as a sound of a jet flying overhead, but it didn't quite sound right. We pretty well realised fairly quickly that it wasn't a jet. It was, again, rockets coming, 107mm Chinese-made rockets, coming into the position. I felt pretty stupid at the time, but I'm glad I said it. I heard this sound, said, "Get down," then got down on one knee, I don't know why. And the first rocket that landed was a dud, so... I thought, oh, maybe I just heard something, and I felt, as I said, pretty stupid. But then the next round that came in wasn't a dud, and it went off pretty close. So we all dived underneath the aircraft. It sounds pretty stupid because that thing's full of fuel. And about six rockets came into hit inside the perimeter on this particular attack. And we, despite that photo, we actually didn't have any body armour on at the time, because we'd taken it off to crawl around the aircraft and have a look. So I felt particularly vulnerable. Now, after the first couple of rounds landed, there was another round that came in, and it just sort of hung in the air. It took forever to come down, and I knew that round was going to be particularly close. Now, we talk about fear, and I've got to say that whilst the thing that happened with Keith, I honestly can't remember being scared at that time, because I was so busy at that time and I didn't really have time to think about anything else. But when I was under this aircraft and this rocket was coming in and it felt like eternity that it was going to land, I was gripping the sand, just expecting the worst, and that's when I sort of knew fear like I'd never known fear before. And that round hit about 30 metres to the left of the screen and put a whole heap of shrapnel into the roof of the aircraft. And one of those rounds, one of those pieces of shrapnel went straight through a control rod. It severed a hydraulic line, and then it hit the transmission and put a big chunk out of that as well. And if you look just down my left boot there, I always point this out because that puddle there is from the hydraulic fluid just draining down the side of the aircraft, and I just want to make sure people know that I didn't actually wet my pants at that stage. So, it was a pretty frightening experience, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I thank God that nothing more happened than a piece of shrapnel hitting the hydraulic line. That's the hole that it made through the control rod. You couldn't drill a more central hole if you tried. And up until that point, we had considered flying the aircraft out because we could still fly it from Keith's or the right-hand seat. But after this, she was completely cactus. So she ended up being underslung in under a Chinook and taken to a US air base and flown out in the back of a C-130. That's my engineer, Kev. Thumbs up then, because the rockets had stopped at this stage and we were playing noughts and crosses in the sand. Righto, 11th, I sort of mentioned we did a bit more patrolling. It was a little bit of a frustrating day because the guys that we found in that observation post actually got away through through a bit of miscommunication between myself and the headquarters, and so that was a bit of a frustrating day. And then on the 12th, we had a bit of a win. We were flying to the east of Dogwood. We'd actually gone to pick up a general, our commanding general from the MND Southeast, up at the airport, and he was going to speak to the United States Marine Corps guys at the base at Kalsu, which was in that sort of introductory video, where we were actually sitting, the aircraft actually based there during the night and then forward mounted to Dogwood during the day. So he was going to speak to them, and on our way, we had to overfly the base at Dogwood, and the Black Watch guys came up on the radio and said, look, we've just been contacted in close vicinity, just to the one of our companies has been contacted, can you go and have a look? So we went and had a look. I pushed the Puma low to do a low pass over this area, and then we sat at altitude and watched them fly over. And the Puma basically came in from here. Camp Dogwood's about over here. The Puma came in through here and flew over what turned out to be an illegal vehicle checkpoint. And then as soon as he went over the top, he was shot at straight away, and then he broke to the south. And we stayed up at altitude and watched what went on from there. And as a result of him flying over the top of that, there's three vehicles there. One vehicle went south along this road here. One went to the west, and one went to the east along here. And that's the Euphrates River there, obviously. We stayed over the top, watched this vehicle as it went into this cemetery here. And then three blokes piled out of the back and decided to have a go, and started shooting up at us. My door gunner called rounds coming around the aircraft, he'd been briefed that if he felt the aircraft was under any sort of threat, then he had my permission to engage, because at this stage I was unsighted. I couldn't see the guys actually shooting at us. And Dinger, to his credit, opened up on the guys and put about 12 rounds down their way, and he didn't hit anyone, but the rounds sort of pretty well pepper-potted around the vehicle and the guys, and as a net result of that, they stopped shooting up at us and they jumped in the vehicle and drove off, and we continued to follow them. Our rules of engagement did not permit us to re-engage at that stage, even though we'd positively identified them as enemy. We were only at that stage allowed to engage them if they posed a threat to us. Now, as a result of this particular incident, the next day they changed the rules of engagement to allow us to engage if we'd positively identified enemy. Anyway, we stayed with this guy as he headed off to the west. He visited a couple of houses, and we got grids for those particular houses. And in the following weeks, the Black Watch did a few operations and on ops on those houses, and got some pretty interesting intelligence and whatnot. So in the end, that was quite a successful operation. We went back, got some fuel after we'd sort of watched these blokes driving around, and shortly coming back on station, we found the car that had headed south was now crossing the river, and we picked him up at this intersection here as he was sort of driving north. As a result of, we followed him into a mosque. There was a big cordon put in around the mosque, and the Brits went in and arrested two guys, found the car was full of circuit boards and bomb-making equipment, detonators and whatnot. They had discarded two 155mm shells as they'd driven into this mosque, and it was a big win for the Brits, and these guys were subsequently arrested. And as a result, a couple of days later, we're having a look at the aircraft, and we found that we'd copped around in the back of the aircraft. And remember, I was at 2,000 feet for this one, so we're at about 600 metres. And you can see the difference in what altitude does to rounds. And at this stage, the round had lost, was starting to lose a fair bit of inertia. It started to tumble, and it pretty well went into the aircraft almost sideways. So it's quite elongated. And that was the damage that was done in the back of the aircraft. In the end, I went back to Basra, and I continued to do a lot of flying around Basra and up around Alamara. I had a few more interesting incidents up there and around in that area, but this was by far and away the most interesting, I suppose, of all the things that I saw whilst I was there. Flew about 180 hours total when I left theatre. That constituted somewhere in the order of 115 sorties or missions. Saw 12 contacts. 5 were IEDs that were detonated on the ground, and we were either there at the time when they were detonated or shortly thereafter. 4 airborne contacts. 3 of those were people shooting at us. One was a rocket attack that was launched at us as we were coming into land. And 3 ground kinetic, so essentially I sat over the top of a shooting match between ground forces on the ground and told them what was going on from our perspective. I was on the receiving end of 8 rocket and mortar attacks, but by far and away none of the other 7, none came anywhere near as close as the one that I described earlier. Had 2 aircraft damaged by hostile action. And I had a mate obviously shot. Just by way of perspective, I've sort of, this is an extra slide that I've sort of added after because I've done a few men's breakfasts, and I've had some people come up to me and say, you know, it's a good thing that you were there and it wasn't me because I don't think I could have done it. And I honestly can't agree with them in that regard because, you know, as I sort of said earlier, you know, I was doing my job. I felt that I didn't feel scared when I was doing the job, if you like. And I think anyone else would be pretty well the same. And it sort of goes back to this sort of elevating of physical courage that we have. And it's not a bad thing. And I'm sure in some ways, even though I don't really see what I did as being courageous, in some ways it was. But for me, you know, demonstrating physical courage, I think, is easier than actually demonstrating moral courage. Now, all of us here, including myself, will rarely be given an opportunity to demonstrate physical courage. You know, once in a blue moon, maybe, but on a daily basis, certainly in my case, and I'm sure it's the same with pretty well everyone here. Demonstrating moral courage, you know, saying the right, saying what is right, and then doing what is right when basically it's not trendy to do so, is a very, very hard thing to do. And I have a lot of admiration for men who are morally courageous men, and I hold them in higher esteem than even those that have display great physical courage. I had a friend who's an SAS officer, and he said that the hardest thing he has ever done wasn't the SAS selection, it was or any operation that he did within the SAS. It was being a Christian and demonstrating that moral courage when, you know, it wasn't popular to do so. And this sort of harps back to what I was saying before, but ordinary men do extraordinary things. And, you know, there's multiple examples in the Bible where God just takes ordinary people, even people that we sort of would even look down upon or will look down upon in their societies, and gets them to do extraordinary things. And that's why I say, like, what I did wasn't particularly extraordinary. I was put into an extraordinary position, but you know, anyone else who would have been put in that position who had my type of training, I think would have done the same thing. Now, I know, I mean, for those of you who aren't Christians here or possibly are standing there or sitting there thinking, well, you know, if somebody else who had done what I had had seen and acted in the same way, they wouldn't attribute the things that they saw and the way that they unfolded to God. They would obviously rely or would talk about how those experiences are either related to their training, to their who they were, or even to luck. And what I'd say to that is that you don't know what you don't know, and people choose not to know God. And so my perspective as a Christian, knowing what I know and how God works in our world, and the grace that He equally shares among both believers and non-believers, gives me a different perspective on how events in this world unfold. And I'm not a believer in luck at all. In this particular example, I can see where God has worked in my life and how He saved me in this particular situation. And that leads me on to God's grace. Now, just as a final point, finish on a verse that I think is quite poignant, and something that, and it's one of my favourite psalms, and obviously it's Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the Maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore.